We need a clean body and a clean mind. A body rendered pure by mind as well as washed by water. One says, I take good care of my body. To do this, the pure and exalting influence of the divine mind on the body is requisite. And the Christian Scientist takes the best care of his body when he leaves it most out of his thought and, like the Apostle Paul, is willing rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. A hint may be taken from the emigrant, whose filth does not affect his happiness because mind and body rest on the same basis. To the mind equally gross, dirt gives no uneasiness. It is the native element of such a mind which is symbolized and not chaffed by its surroundings. But impurity and uncleanliness, which do not trouble the gross, could not be borne by the refined. This shows that the mind must be clean to keep the body in proper condition. The tobacco user, eating or smoking poison for half a century, sometimes tells you that the weed preserves his health. But does this make it so? Does his assertion prove the use of tobacco to be a salubrious habit, and man to be the better for it? Such instances only prove the elusive physical effect of a false belief, confirming the scriptural conclusion concerning a man: as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. The movement cure, pinching and pounding the poor body to make it sensibly well when it ought to be insensibly so, is another medical mistake, resulting from the common notion that health depends on inert matter instead of on mind. Can matter, or what is termed matter, either feel or act without mind? We should relieve our minds from the depressing thought that we have transgressed a material law and must of necessity pay the penalty. Let us reassure ourselves with the law of love. God never punishes man for doing right, for honest labor, or for deeds of kindness, though they expose him to fatigue, cold, heat, contagion. If man seems to incur the penalty through matter, this is but a belief of mortal mind, not an enactment of wisdom. And man has only to enter his protest against this belief in order to annul it. Through this action of thought and its results upon the body, the student will prove to himself by small beginnings the grand verities of Christian Science. If exposure to a draft of air while in a state of perspiration is followed by chills, dry cough, influenza, congestive symptoms in the lungs, or hints of inflammatory rheumatism, your mind remedy is safe and sure. If you are a Christian Scientist, such symptoms are not apt to follow exposure. But if you believe in laws of matter and their fatal effects when transgressed, you are not fit to conduct your own case or to destroy the bad effects of your belief. When the fear subsides and the conviction abides that you have broken no law, neither rheumatism, consumption, nor any other disease will ever result from exposure to the weather. In science, this is an established fact which all the evidence before the senses can never overrule. Sickness, sin, and death must at length quail before the divine rights of intelligence, and then the power of mind over the entire functions and organs of the human system will be acknowledged. It is proverbial that Florence Nightingale and other philanthropists engaged in humane labors have been able to undergo without sinking fatigues and exposures which ordinary people could not endure. The explanation lies in the support which they derived from the divine law, rising above the human. The spiritual demand, quelling the material, supplies energy and endurance surpassing all other aids, and forestalls the penalty which our beliefs would attach to our best deeds. Let us remember that the eternal law of right, though it can never annul the law which makes sin its own executioner, exempts man from all penalties but those due for wrongdoing. Constant toil, deprivations, exposures, and all untoward conditions, if without sin, can be experienced without suffering. Whatever it is your duty to do, you can do without harm to yourself. If you sprain the muscles or wound the flesh, your remedy is at hand. Mind decides whether or not the flesh shall be discolored, painful, swollen, and inflamed. You say that you have not slept well or have overeaten. You are a law unto yourself. Saying this and believing it, you will suffer in proportion to your belief and fear. Your sufferings are not the penalty for having broken a law of matter, for it is a law of mortal mind which you have disobeyed. You say or think because you have partaken of salt fish that you must be thirsty, and you are thirsty accordingly, while the opposite belief would produce the opposite result. Any supposed information coming from the body or from inert matter, as if either were intelligent, is an illusion of mortal mind, one of its dreams. Realize that the evidence of the senses is not to be accepted in the case of sickness any more than it is in the case of sin. Expose the body to certain temperatures, and belief says that you may catch cold and have catarrh. But no such result occurs without mind to demand it and produce it. So long as mortals declare that certain states of the atmosphere produce catarrh, fever, rheumatism, or consumption, those effects will follow, not because of the climate, but on account of the belief. The author has in too many instances healed disease through the action of truth on the minds of mortals, and the corresponding effects of truth on the body, not to know that this is so. A blundering dispatch, mistakenly announcing the death of a friend, occasions the same grief that the friend's real death would bring. You think that your anguish is occasioned by your loss. Another dispatch, correcting the mistake, heals your grief, and you learn that your suffering was merely the result of your belief. Thus it is with all sorrow, sickness, and death. You will learn at length that there is no cause for grief, and divine wisdom will then be understood. Error, not truth, produces all the suffering on earth. If a Christian Scientist had said, while you were laboring under the influence of the belief of grief, your sorrow is without cause, you would not have understood him. although the correctness of the assertion might afterwards be proved to you. So when our friends pass from our sight and we lament, that lamentation is needless and causeless. We shall perceive this to be true when we grow into the understanding of life and know that there is no death. Because mortal mind is kept active, must it pay the penalty in a softened brain? Who dares to say that actual mind can be overworked? When we reach our limits of mental endurance, we conclude that intellectual labor has been carried sufficiently far. But when we realize that immortal mind is ever active, and that spiritual energies can neither wear out nor can so-called material law trespass upon God-given powers and resources, we are able to rest in truth, refreshed by the assurances of immortality, opposed to mortality. Our thinkers do not die early because they faithfully perform the natural functions of being. If printers and authors have the shortest span of earthly existence, it is not because they occupy the most important posts and perform the most vital functions in society. That man does not pay the severest penalty who does the most good. By adhering to the realities of eternal existence, instead of reading disquisitions on the inconsistent supposition that death comes in obedience to the law of life, and that God punishes man for doing good, one cannot suffer as the result of any labor of love, but grows stronger because of it. It is a law of so-called mortal mind, misnamed matter, which causes all things discordant. The history of Christianity furnishes sublime proofs of the supporting influence and protecting power bestowed on man by his heavenly Father, Omnipotent Mind, who gives man faith and understanding whereby to defend himself, not only from temptation, but from bodily suffering. The Christian martyrs were prophets of Christian Science. Through the uplifting and consecrating power of divine truth, they obtained a victory over the corporeal senses, a victory which science alone can explain. Stolidity, which is a resisting state of mortal mind, suffers less only because it knows less of material law. The Apostle John testified to the divine basis of Christian Science when dire inflictions failed to destroy his body. Idolaters, believing in more than one mind, had gods many, and thought that they could kill the body with matter independently of mind. Admit the common hypothesis that food is the nutriment of life, and there follows the necessity for another admission in the opposite direction, that food has power to destroy life, God, through a deficiency or an excess, a quality or a quantity. This is a specimen of the ambiguous nature of all material health theories. They are self-contradictory and self-destructive, constituting a kingdom divided against itself, which is brought to desolation. If food was prepared by Jesus for his disciples, it cannot destroy life. The fact is, food does not affect the absolute life of man, and this becomes self-evident when we learn that God is our life. Because sin and sickness are not qualities of soul or life, we have hope in immortality. But it would be foolish to venture beyond our present understanding, foolish to stop eating until we gain perfection and a clear comprehension of the living spirit. In that perfect day of understanding, we shall neither eat to live nor live to eat. If mortals think that food disturbs the harmonious functions of mind and body, either the food or this thought must be dispensed with, for the penalty is coupled with the belief. Which shall it be? If this decision be left to Christian Science, it will be given in behalf of the control of mind over this belief and every erroneous belief or material condition. The less we know or think about hygiene, the less we are predisposed to sickness. Recollect that it is not the nerves, not matter, but mortal mind which reports food as undigested. Matter does not inform you of bodily derangements. It is supposed to do so. This pseudo-mental testimony can be destroyed only by the better results of mind's opposite evidence. Our dietetic theories first admit that food sustains the life of man and then discuss the certainty that food can kill man. This false reasoning is rebuked in Scripture by the metaphors about the fount and stream, the tree and its fruit, and the kingdom divided against itself. If God has, as prevalent theories maintain, instituted laws that food shall support human life, he cannot annul these regulations by an opposite law that food shall be inimical to existence. Materialists contradict their own statements. Their belief in material laws and in penalties for their infraction is the ancient error that there is fraternity between pain and pleasure, good and evil, God and Satan. This belief totters to its falling before the battle axe of science. A case of convulsions produced by indigestion came under my observation. In her belief, the woman had chronic liver complaint and was then suffering from a complication of symptoms connected with this belief. I cured her in a few minutes. One instant, she spoke despairingly of herself. The next minute, she said, "My food is all digested, and I should like something more to eat." We cannot deny that life is self-sustained, and we should never deny the everlasting harmony of soul, simply because to the mortal senses there is seeming discord. It is our ignorance of God, the divine principle, which produces apparent discord, and the right understanding of Him restores harmony. Truth will at length compel us all to exchange the pleasures and pains of sense for the joys of soul. When the first symptoms of disease appear, dispute the testimony of the material senses with divine science. Let your higher sense of justice destroy the false process of mortal opinions, which you name law, and then you will not be confined to a sick room, nor laid upon a bed of suffering in payment of the last farthing, the last penalty demanded by error. Agree with thine adversary quickly whilst thou art in the way with him. suffer no claim of sin or of sickness to grow upon the thought. Dismiss it with an abiding conviction that it is illegitimate, because you know that God is no more the author of sickness than he is of sin. You have no law of his to support the necessity either of sin or sickness, but you have divine authority for denying that necessity and healing the sick. Agree to disagree with approaching symptoms of chronic or acute disease, whether it is cancer, consumption, or smallpox. Meet the incipient stages of disease with as powerful mental opposition as a legislator would employ to defeat the passage of an inhuman law. Rise in the conscious strength of the spirit of truth to overthrow the plea of mortal mind alias matter, arrayed against the supremacy of spirit. Blot out the images of mortal thought and its beliefs in sickness and sin. Then, when thou art delivered to the judgment of truth, Christ, the judge will say, "Thou art whole." Instead of blind and calm submission to the incipient or advanced stages of disease, rise in rebellion against them. Banish the belief that you can possibly entertain a single intruding pain which cannot be ruled out by the might of mind, and in this way you can prevent the development of pain in the body. No law of God hinders this result. It is error to suffer for aught but your own sins. Christ or truth will destroy all other supposed suffering, and real suffering for your own sins will cease in proportion as the sin ceases. Justice is the moral signification of law. Injustice declares the absence of law. When the body is supposed to say, "I am sick," never plead guilty. Since matter cannot talk, it must be mortal mind which speaks. Therefore, meet the intimation with a protest. If you say, "I am sick," you plead guilty. Then your adversary will deliver you to the judge, mortal mind, and the judge will sentence you. Disease has no intelligence to declare itself something and announce its name. Mortal mind alone sentences itself. Therefore, make your own terms with sickness and be just to yourself and to others. Mentally contradict every complaint from the body and rise to the true consciousness of life as love, as all that is pure and bearing the fruits of spirit. Fear is the fountain of sickness, and you master fear and sin through divine mind. Hence it is through divine mind that you overcome disease. Only while fear or sin remains can it bring forth death. To cure a bodily ailment, every broken moral law should be taken into account, and the error be rebuked. Fear, which is an element of all disease, must be cast out to readjust the balance for God. Casting out evil and fear enables truth to outweigh error. The only course is to take antagonistic grounds against all that is opposed to the health, holiness, and harmony of man, God's image. The physical affirmation of disease should always be met with the mental negation. Whatever benefit is produced on the body must be expressed mentally, and thought should be held fast to this ideal. If you believe in inflamed and weak nerves, you are liable to an attack from that source. You will call it neuralgia, but we call it a belief. If you think that consumption is hereditary in your family, you are liable to the development of that thought in the form of what is termed pulmonary disease, unless science shows you otherwise. If you decide that climate or atmosphere is unhealthy, it will be so to you. Your decisions will master you whichever direction they take. Reverse the case. Stand porter at the door of thought, admitting only such conclusions as you wish realized in bodily results. You will control yourself harmoniously. When the condition is present which you say induces disease, whether it be air, exercise, heredity, contagion, or accident, then perform your office as porter and shut out these unhealthy thoughts and fears. Exclude from mortal mind the offending errors. Then the body cannot suffer from them. The issues of pain or pleasure must come through mind, and like a watchman forsaking his post, we admit the intruding belief, forgetting that through divine help we can forbid this entrance. The body seems to be self-acting only because mortal mind is ignorant of itself, of its own actions, and of their results, ignorant that the predisposing, remote, and exciting cause of all bad effects is a law of so-called mortal mind, not of matter. Mind is the master of the corporeal senses and can conquer sickness, sin, and death. Exercise this God-given authority. Take possession of your body and govern its feeling and action. Rise in the strength of spirit to resist all that is unlike good. God has made man capable of this, and nothing can vitiate the ability and power divinely bestowed on man. Be firm in your understanding that the divine mind governs, and that in science man reflects God's government. Have no fear that matter can ache, swell, and be inflamed as the result of a law of any kind, when it is self-evident that matter can have no pain nor inflammation. Your body would suffer no more from tension or wounds than the trunk of a tree which you gash, or the electric wire which you stretch, were it not for mortal mind. When Jesus declares that the light of the body is the eye, he certainly means that light depends upon mind, not upon the complex humors, lenses, muscles, the iris and pupil constituting the visual organism. Man is never sick, for mind is not sick, and matter cannot be. A false belief is both the tempter and the tempted, the sin and the sinner, the disease and its cause. It is well to be calm in sickness. To be hopeful is still better. But to understand that sickness is not real, and that truth can destroy its seeming reality, is best of all. For this understanding is the universal and perfect remedy.